Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest edition of the Pro Basketball Talk podcast here at NBC Sports. I'm Kurt Heelan, the managing editor of the NBA page at NBC, with you today. And a little bit of a deviation from our preseason package we've been doing a little of, talking about, and there's a lot more of this coming, what to expect this season, MVP predictions, our predictions for the season, and looking at coaches on the hot seat and all of it. Today we're actually taking a diversion to talk about a coach not on the hot seat in Steve Kerr in Golden State. Scott Howard Cooper, one of my favorite people from the NBA writing business, has finished a book on Kerr called Steve Kerr: A Life that delves into everything from his very interesting and eclectic youth to his college time at Arizona, his NBA career, which was, is a solid. I mean, we think now of the 5 championships in the 15 years in the league, but that was not easy for him to stick around. He wasn't expected to. And obviously onto his coaching career. We're going to delve into all of it. It's a fascinating conversation and a fascinating book. And well, thank you for listening. And we'll be back later this week, of course, with a lot more season previews. But for now, let's welcome in Scott Howard Cooper and talk a little Steve Kerr. How are you doing, Scott Howard Cooper? It's good to talk to you, man.
Thanks, Kurt. Always good to connect. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. And we kind of bring you in at a fortuitous time. The Warriors are back in the news, kind of back on the we will get into this a little more. They're down the line, but they're coming. This is the season where there's a potential comeback for them. But Steve Kerr's kind of in the news right now as a guy who's a front runner for the Team USA coaching job with Greg Popovich. I know Mark Stein had reported this, but you had actually talked about this like a month ago. I guess it's in the book.
Yeah, that's certainly not new information by any means. It's in the book. We talk about that a little bit, his path to becoming an assistant coach, how the sort of behind the scenes on the selection process and how things look coming out of the Olympics and moving forward, that whenever it's time to name Greg Popovich's successor, there's no question that Steve Kerr is the front runner. They like Jay Wright at USA Basketball. They like Jay Wright, the Villanova coach, an awful lot. But Steve has an advantage. He's got a really good relationship with Grant Hill. He's got the credibility with the players. He's got the experience. And every indication is that they're still going to go in the NBA direction, not the Jay Wright NCAA direction. So at that point, it probably comes down to Kerr and Spoelstra, and Steve wins easily. This is something that's been out there for a while. It's discussed in the book, and I had it on Twitter, so it's something that I think is a pretty obvious selection when the time comes.
Yeah, the only other NBA name I had heard is Monty Williams was intriguing them, but he doesn't have the international assistant coaching experience that Steve does.
USA Basketball likes to put a premium on people who have been in the program for a while, on loyalty, and that's with players as well as coaches. And that gives Steve a big advantage over Monty, over Spoelstra. You really have to search hard to come up with a reason that it wouldn't be Steve, and I can't find one. It would be a shocking development unless he changes his mind for whatever reason. If it's not Steve.
And one thing that's been interesting in his coaching career, and you kind of touch on this a lot in the book, and it's something I tried to get Grant Hill to talk about a little last week and in our podcast with him, but he, I don't want to say dodged it, but he lumped it in with other things, which is Steve Kerr brings to the table this, he gets along with players as a player, but he gets along with kind of everyone. He gets along with Draymond Green. He gets along, I guess, with Kevin Durant, although that one maybe is a little more tenuous now. But he gets along with a variety of players, and you kind of need somebody at USA Basketball who guys want to play for, who want to play with. He's kind of got to have that connection, and Kerr kind of brings that to the table.
There's no question that it's a unique role. Players don't have to be there. It's not like their NBA season that if you don't get along with the coach, you got to put up with it. As we've seen for many Olympic cycles now, world championship cycles, guys are just going to bail.
Yeah.
And if there's a coach there that has a bad reputation that people have had a lot of bad experiences with, I think you're going to, that that's one of the things that USA Basketball is very conscious of, is that there's got to be somebody that people want to give up part of their summer to come play with, play for, and Steve certainly fits that bill. He's one of the most popular people in the NBA of the last 25 or 30 years, and that's coaches, players, as a teammate for many years when he was a GM, and obviously as a broadcaster. His personality is one of the best things that Steve has going for himself.
So you finished the book a while ago, actually. I'm like, we had kind of discussed off air. It's a book that, like many things, kind of got tied up in COVID and pushed back a little bit. But you started this book a while ago as the Warriors era was coming. I don't want to say era was coming to an end, but the run of five championships had kind of come to an end. Was the book you envisioned writing the one you ended up with?
You mean at the very start or once I switched to Steve Kerr?
What was, I guess, how did this project come about then?
Because it is a little bit of a swerving path, not a huge one, but a little bit. Had originally started out going to do something, a big picture look on the Warriors, the rise of Golden State, this team that had been fun to watch for many years but never was going to be a threat for a championship. They'd become lottery regulars and floundering in all sorts of different ways. And then all of a sudden, they're winning championships every year. And I'd put together the majority of a proposal and a sample chapter and put things together on the rise of the Warriors. And it was just a matter of Golden State was going to beat Toronto in the finals. And then my agent and I were going to go ahead and sell that book. Well, apparently Kawhi Leonard didn't like that idea, and the injury gods didn't like that idea, because once the Raptors, in fact, beat the Warriors, not the way a lot of people envisioned, it would have been the wrong time to try to sell something on the success of the Warriors right after they had lost in the finals. And my agent encouraged me to look at Steve Kerr's story as a standalone. And at first I was not thrilled with the idea, and he encouraged me, said, you know what, just write a few paragraphs, sit down for a week and do some research, dig into it a little bit. And he was 100% right, and in pretty short order I went from thinking, yeah, okay, I'll do this, to okay, this is going to work, there's enough there, to I looked up suddenly and was telling myself, I can't believe nobody has done this yet. There's just so much there to his life, and that was really the selling point. It's not Steve Kerr, the basketball coach and basketball player with a unique career path. It's that this guy had such a fascinating life that you can write a story and obviously include Michael Jordan and Phil Jackson and Greg Popovich and Steph Curry, all of the expected, but you're in there talking about Kim Jong-un and Steve Kerr in the Oval Office with President Reagan and Vice President Bush. There's a direct connection to Yasser Arafat that's in there. 9/11, Pearl Harbor. It's a little bit of a Forrest Gump quality almost, that this guy's life has been touched in so many different ways by unique happenings in the world that it goes well beyond a typical sports book. And that's one of the things that really appealed to me.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's interesting about reading this. You don't dwell on, like a lot of biographies have, sports biographies have done, which is dwell on the game moments as much. It's not that you ignore big games or don't talk about them, but this is much more personality driven than we're going to, you don't spend five pages on a game.
You're right. And that was on purpose. There's a couple moments that we zero in on. Obviously, the biggest of his playing career was Game 6 with the Bulls to win the championship when he hits the shot. He had a big moment in the Western Conference Finals as a member of the Spurs. He had a disastrous moment when he was at University of Arizona, the Final Four against Oklahoma in Kansas City. And so there are some of those moments that we do a deep dive and spend a few different pages. I think on his shot to beat the Jazz in the 1997 finals, we maybe do, 1,000 words just on that one shot alone. So there are those basketball moments, but it is not by any means a book that you're going to see loaded with statistics. It is not an X's and O's coaching book where it talks about you know, why he ran this play in that moment or anything. It is personality driven. It's, as I said, it's about a unique career, but a fascinating life that goes well beyond what he did on the court.
And I think he's fascinating in the sense that on a few levels, but one of the things that clearly comes through in the book is, look, on the surface, those of you obviously have interviewed him and been around him a lot over the years. I've certainly been in the room and spoken with him at, on and off the record at USA Basketball here. And like on the surface, he is a very funny guy. He is easy to talk to. He is self-deprecating. There's a lot of humor there. But the more you're around him, the more you realize he is a really driven, fiery competitor under that. That kind of underscores how he got where he is.
And I think that that's one of something that has really come out in his Golden State years, because he's been caught on camera slamming a clipboard.
Yeah.
You know, he will break things. He will get angry at people. And I think most people didn't realize that about him for many years, probably most, if not all, of his playing career. He played 15 years, and I think, oh, yeah, you know, nice guy, funny, smart, works really hard, but just kind of this, it started when he was young. He would be at University of Arizona, and there was a lot of howdy-doody and Opie and Mr. Goody Two-Shoes. You know, he's just sort of this blonde hair surfer dude looking kid from Pacific Palisades, California. And nobody ever really saw that fire very often. We bring it out, I think, at different moments. There's some times where he got in a fight on the court. There's obviously the very famous run-in he had with Michael Jordan that ended very badly for Steve on the, you know, physically, because he ended up with a black eye and Michael kicked his butt in about 10 seconds, but worked out very well for Steve emotionally and career-wise, because he kind of earned Michael's respect that way in a way that never would have happened otherwise. He stood up to Michael Jordan, and that's something that really scored points with Michael. So, yeah, he is much more intense than most people realize.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think a lot of fans, younger fans, they didn't know that much about him, and The Last Dance kind of changed some of that, right? Like, suddenly he's this character in The Last Dance who's, right, the guy who stands up to Jordan and gets punched, but by the end is the trusted teammate, right? The guy Jordan will pass the ball to at the end of Game 6 of a Finals and trust him to knock down that shot. It's a long path to being that guy, though, for Kerr, who's, I mean, if we're going to go back to this, he barely landed a scholarship out of college to a major. I mean, he ended up with Lute Olson and this powerhouse at Arizona, but barely.
Well, that's one of the reasons we called it Steve Kerr a Life, because we wanted to take readers all the way through and not just make it about coaching the Warriors or even as a player. But even before that, from his youth growing up, he gets to high school, and you're right, he's nobody. That you talk about a guy that had a 15-year NBA career. I bet there's a lot of people in Los Angeles who couldn't even tell you what high school he went to.
Yeah,
it's not like he was one of the latest off the assembly line of Southern California.
No, he is
stars.
He's not the Shea Cotton, the guys who have been hyped out of, and as somebody who's lived in Southern California and gone to high school, it was like he, I mean, granted that was a long time ago, but he was way under the radar.
Well, yeah, I don't even know if he could have found the radar. He had no business being at Arizona, and that was even on a really bad Arizona program. They had gone 4-24 the year before. Lute Olson was brought in and is trying for Kevin Johnson and Reggie Miller, loses out on both, and Steve had already graduated high school, and he still didn't have a college home, and he ends up playing in one of the summer league tournaments at Cal State Long Beach, and Lute is there scouting people for the next recruiting class, and he's got one scholarship to give, and he looks out there, he says, who's that guy? You know, has no idea who he is. That tells you everything about Steve Kerr. that the coaches had no idea who he was. You know, smart player, can hit a shot, looks like he can run an offense. Everybody's going to go past him on defense, but you know what? I've got one scholarship to give, and he checks the guy out, and Steve is, you know, they tell Steve that we can't give you a visit. We're out of visits, and it's late. It's June. It's July. It's getting late into summer. And Steve's like, I don't care. I'll take it. I'm coming. He almost ended up at Cal State Fullerton, but finally, through a series of miscommunications, but finally ended up at Arizona. And it turned out to be really where his life changed, not only basketball-wise. It's where he made his future NBA career. It's where he made his name nationally. He met his future wife. He met a lot of people who to this day remain his closest friends. So when we say he had no business being at Arizona, being at the Pac-10 at the time, now the Pac-12, but being in the Pac-10, he's the first one to admit that. This is a guy that has constantly turned bad into good and has overcome these sort of basketball setbacks. He had no business being recruited to the Pac-10. Number 50 pick in the draft, and he ends up playing 15 years. It's just one thing after another that when we talk about Steve Kerr life, it's about that backstory that is so amazing.
And the thing that comes through is he genuinely values the positives in his life. I mean, he really both appreciates it and understands it, but values not just the positives in terms of what happened with him, you know, getting to go to Arizona stuff, but the relationships that he builds. He takes this stuff very seriously.
Oh, he gets it. He knows how lucky he is. There's a lot of positives about Steve and his personality, but I think that you hit on the right word when you said appreciative. He knows how fortunate he has been in all aspects of his life, certainly professionally. The guy that never thought he could play at a big school in college, the guy who never thought until his senior year of college that he would play in the NBA. And then when he did start to get that sense, once he was having a really good senior year, he said, maybe if things break just right, maybe I can get a year or two of the NBA out of this. Yeah. And then I'll go into coaching, maybe into athletic director, athletic administration, but probably coaching. That was his career path, was to squeeze a year out of the NBA, and then ends up playing 15. And he gets it. This is not an ego run amok where he was like, I got this. And, you know, people talk about you got to believe and everything. He didn't believe. His lack of confidence was a problem the entire time. I would also make the case that more than lack of confidence, it was the right amount of being realistic, because he was not alone in thinking he couldn't play. So, there were plenty of college coaches that, again, didn't recognize him. He lived when he was at going to Palisades High School. That's a, 10-15 minute drive, depending on traffic, to UCLA.
Yeah.
And his dad was in the political science department at UCLA for 20 years. He couldn't get the Bruins to let him on campus. They wouldn't even give him a visit. This guy that ends up playing 15 years in the NBA and live practically down the street. He's appreciative. He gets it. He knows that this thing has worked out a million times better than it had a right to.
Speaking of his father, that obviously is one of the big turning points in his career. And I think something a few people do know about, because it does come up when through Steve Kerr's, you know, even for casual fans, talking a little bit. His father, Dr. Malcolm Kerr, was at UCLA, but then took the job as president of the American University in Beirut, and was assassinated while Kerr was at the University of Arizona. And I can't imagine how you overcome that and come back to playing basketball.
It speaks to his resiliency, because I think that I certainly share that same feeling, and I think most other people would. He's a college freshman. It's January of 1984. He's been in town a few months. It's not like he knew people that well. He knew he got his buddies from the team and maybe some other people from the dorm, but it's not like he had been in Tucson as a junior or a senior, that he knew a lot of people there. It's not like he was someplace close to Los Angeles that he could go home at night if he needed to. Again, he originally considered Cal State Fullerton before going to Arizona, and so that would have been a different opportunity. You're much closer to your support base. As it turns out, he's in Tucson, and there's no family. His immediate family is either back east, in terms of his grandparents or aunts and uncles. He's got a set of grandparents in Southern California, but his mom and his siblings are in the Middle East when this happens, and Steve has to sort of figure all this out on his own with nobody to rely on. And the teammates stepped up, and Lute Olson and his wife and the assistant coaches all stepped up, but still, he's a college freshman, far from home and trying to figure out how to sort this through, because he and his dad had a very good relationship. They were close. This was the loss of a parent and a friend at the same time, somebody that he loved dearly and relied on. And the one thing he knew pretty quick was that he's going to stay with the team and not go to the Middle East for the services, to be with his family in the church. And Lute says, well, at least take some time. Just go somewhere, get away from basketball, take care of yourself. That matters, basketball doesn't. And Steve was adamant. He said, I need to be around basketball. I need to be around this team. I can't go someplace and just sit and stare at the walls for 24 hours a day, even if it is with my loving family. So he stayed. He stayed and played basketball. And 2 days later, turns in an amazing performance against Arizona State that people in Tucson are still talking about.
There were so many great stories I had not heard about Steve through this. But the one that kind of stunned me was the senior year at Arizona State where, you know, he's a senior guard at this point. Like you said, he's starting to be known around a little bit. And rival Arizona State fans taunted him about the assassination of his father. And again, I think you mentioned the word resilient. He bounces back. He's almost in tears, but he bounces back and drops, I think it was 22 on them.
No, he was in tears.
Yeah.
That's another thing about Steve is what you see is what you get. He doesn't hide it. He was in tears the night that, when I talked about the first game back after losing his father, on the court before the game, he was in tears, and doesn't care that people can see this. Same thing, it's a senior year in Tempe at Arizona State this time, and it wasn't all the ASU fans. It was about, I think they said 12, maybe 15. It was a small group, but it's before the game. The team is not drawing well, so it's almost like an echo chamber. If somebody is yelling something on one side of the arena, people on the other side can hear it.
So it's old Clipper games. Okay.
I was going to say, and this is the definition of disgusting, that these people are chanting PLO and Beirut, and they're just yelling at Steve about the assassination of his father by terrorists. And it was just awful. And he drops the ball. He's, you know, pregame shooting, drops the ball, goes over to the bench and is in tears and just sitting there. And some of his teammates are about ready to go up into the stands to take these people on. And thankfully, there were enough people there with a heart and soul beyond, you know, just fans, people who didn't know him, that would come by and give him a pat on the shoulder and, you know, this is not us. These are not our fans, who we want to be. There were enough decent people there, but that, oh my God, what a horrible night. Horrible.
He had another rough situation while we're at Arizona. I mean, he had a knee injury that people bounce back from today, but back in 1986, a knee injury almost ended his career.
It's the summer after his junior season. He's playing for Team USA in the World Championships in Spain, And he sort of gets caught in the air, twisting between, can I make a pass to Charles Smith off to the side, or should I take the shot? And gets caught in the air and lands awkwardly and blows out his knee. And that very night, before he'd even left the arena, before he'd gone, taken a single x-ray, gone, not even on the team bus, the doctor, the Team USA doctor says, your career is probably over.
Oh my God.
And this is a guy for whom basketball was much more than a sport or an opportunity or a college scholarship. Remember, he used basketball to try to get him through the loss of his father. That's how much basketball meant to him. And here he is after his junior year, being told that his career is probably over, and he's on the bus and he's in tears, and he goes back to his hotel room and is on the phone with his mom in Los Angeles. He's in Madrid calling his mom in Los Angeles in tears. My career is probably over. This is horrible and everything. That's how bad it was. But this was also one of the great Steve Kerr moments. There's a knock on the door. He had already told the reporters what room he's in. Come on by and see me. He knew that two guys had come from all the way from Tucson to go to Europe to cover this, because that's how big a deal it was in Arizona with Lute Olson as the coach and Sean Elliott and Steve Kerr on the team. He sees them on the bus and said, I know you need to talk to me. Come to my room. It's one of the worst nights of my life, but sure, come to my room. And so one of the guys is in the room as Steve is on the phone with his mom in tears, talking about how his career is probably over. And in the strange twist that becomes sort of one of the Steve Kerr trademarks, this horrible moment turns into one of the best things to ever happen to him, because he redshirts what would have been his senior year, comes back a year later, and the team is much better. Sean Elliott is a year older, and he's a machine. He's just a dominant force. The Wildcats are much better. Steve is a year older and he's stronger. His legs are in better shape than ever because he had focused on those in the rehab. The opposite of a setback, it made him a better shooter because it forced him to develop his legs. The three-point shot was in place by that season. And he ends up being one of the best players on the best team in the country and turning into an NBA draft pick. And the case can be made that none of that would have happened if he didn't blow his knee out.
I will say this, and it dates me a little bit age-wise, but one of my favorite chants ever, and one of the, I think, just one of those classic college basketball moments, is the Steve Kerr chant in Tucson when he would hit threes.
It's great. It's fantastic.
And I don't know if I didn't even look before I spoke to you if there's YouTube clips of this out there or not. But I mean, if as I remember it, the announcer would you know, three pointer or whatever, Steve Kerr, and the whole crowd would yell, Steve Kerr. It was amazing.
It became one of the great traditions in college basketball because it would sort of get drawn out a little bit. And as a matter of fact, I the title of one of the chapters is Steve Kerr, because the PA guy would say it, and then it started off as the band kind of doing it a little bit, and then it became the entire arena doing it, and now it's 2021, and he could show up back at McHale Center or probably almost anywhere in Tucson, and he is going to hear that. He returned to Tucson to give the commencement address after he retired from the NBA, and you know what he heard, Steve Kerr. And that is something that has stayed with him, and it's awesome. It's just one of those great atmosphere, one of those great settings of college sports.
So he gets drafted 50th, and you mentioned this before, he didn't think he was going to stick in the NBA, you know, and statistically, by the way, 50th picks don't stick in the NBA. Once you get to the middle of the second round, it's where, you know, yeah, there's the Manu Ginobili's and what have you. It's the, and Steve Kerr, they are the exceptions to the rule. Most of these guys never even touch the court. What kind of mindset, what did he bring that, what did he realize he needed to do to stick?
To be professional And there's always been a maturity about him, even when he was in high school. I talked to some of his high school teachers and classmates and people who knew him back then. And this was not your typical 15, 16, 17-year-old. And a lot of that is his parents' upbringing and having lived in different places around the world. He spent a lot of time growing up in the Middle East. So he understood that the world did not revolve around Steve Kerr and his cool clothes or what car he had. So there's always been that professionalism, and he understood that he couldn't show up and be a jerk anywhere because right. he didn't have that much room, But the other thing about him, and this has always been the case, is his mantra was to always be prepared. And it's corny, but it really is so true with him. And we talked about it before, that big moment with Michael Jordan in the 97 finals. That's because Steve was prepared, that he would do all the fun stuff at practices, like shooting games and goofing around with teammates and things like that, but only after he had put the work in. He may not have played for 2 weeks in a row, but he's not only out there getting an extra shooting, he's taking the shots that he would have an opportunity to take during the games. You know, when you see a lot of guys out there during pregame warmups or after practices, and they're trying their half-court hook shots or these goofy, pass off the backboard to themselves kind of thing. Steve was 20-footer from the left side, 18-footer from the right side, free throws, everything that you would think that he would get during the games. Preparation was a huge part of it, of his mindset, and that's a huge reason he stuck around.
He gets drafted to Phoenix, and I think when we talk about the influences on Steve Kerr as a coach, we always talk about Lute Olson at Arizona and obviously Phil Jackson and Greg Popovich. He spent a year under legendary coach Cotton Fitzsimmons in Phoenix on a team that made the Western Conference Finals in Phoenix. He was barely playing, but Kerr is on that team. And you talk in the book, he took stuff away from Cotton.
He loved Cotton. He only had 1 year with him. But you're right, all the attention goes to Phil and to Pop and to Lute. Cotton had a large influence on him, largely about the personality of how to be a successful coach, because Cotton was so well-liked. And it's not just because he knew how to coach. That team won. He put guys in the right situation. So he understood that it was much more than an X's and O's situation. You know, Lute was a genius, and Steve could not have been in a better college situation, but he did not have this big personality. And as soon as he got to the NBA, he got with Cotton, who did have this big personality. And Steve took from that a lot of what it takes in terms of atmosphere and the mood you want to set to keep your players loose, to make sure you're having fun during this long, long season or some 5-game road trip through snowy conditions or something, that there's, you got to have fun. You got to connect with people. It was a lot about personality. And then another guy from there, he goes to Cleveland. And again, Lenny Wilkins is not mentioned a lot in the Steve Kerr story arc, but again, a different personality than Cotton, much more of the Lute Olson type, where he's smart but he's understated. Lenny does not have that big personality, but he's respected like few others. And Lenny had a profound impact on him as well.
He obviously, you know, like you said, he ends up with the Bulls, and then eventually the Spurs, and that becomes legendary. He comes out of the NBA after 15 years, and I don't get the impression he thought he was going to be a coach. That was not kind of where he pictured his career heading. In fact, he was broadcasting.
Yeah, I think for a long time he thought, I'm going to be one of the guys who succeeds Lute.
Yeah.
Maybe not eventually. I think he loved the college game so much and sort of how it felt and everything. And sort of had thought, I can see coaching in my future, but not for a long time. He had three kids. He had a wonderful family situation when he was growing up and wanted to provide the same thing for his family. He had, as I said, met his wife when he was in college and had his three kids, and he didn't want to be away constantly as he knew he would have to be. He had done that as a player and didn't want to go into that as a coach. And there were people that had interest in him as a coach right away. It's amazing how his life had changed, because the guy that couldn't beg a college scholarship, almost couldn't beg an NBA, being drafted by the NBA, by the time he leaves the NBA, within a couple of years, there's people that are interested in him as a coach and or as a general manager. And it's pretty remarkable, but he held it off. He was adamant about it. He said, I'm not going to get into a situation where I'm going to be gone from my family and all those long road trips all the time. So he understood what it took to be a good coach, and he was honest with himself. He said, I don't want to put in that time right now. And so he kind of took a job in the NBA Barca Lounge. He became a broadcaster.
He eventually does become a GM, and I think that that's one of the other interesting parts of the book. You don't really pull punches. He struggled in that role, and you know, for people who don't remember, he was coming in closer to the end of the 7 seconds or less era. They'd had some success. They hadn't been able to get over the hump. Kerr is the guy who brought in Shaquille O'Neal, which I think a lot of us at the time went, really? You're doing what? But he struggled in that role, and you don't really pull a lot of punches there.
It was a difficult role for him. It's not one he really wanted. I think he felt guilted into it by the owner. He had been Robert Sarver bought the team after Steve Kerr gave Sarver an introduction to David Stern. And that sort of set the wheels in motion of Sarver eventually buying the team. And Sarver, in an act of gratitude, basically gifted Steve Kerr, I think it was 1% or 1.5% of the team, as sort of a thank you, and makes him an advisor or gives him some nifty title about special assistant to the owner or something like that. But Steve really isn't doing much in the basketball side. He's at that point, he's sort of vice president of shaking hands or making an appearance in Tucson if they're trying to promote an exhibition game down there or something. Didn't want to do it. Basically got guilted into it because Sarver had given him free money of the ownership share, and ends up doing it and liked some parts, but really reminded him most of all on why he wanted to be a coach. That the coach, you're in that huddle, and Steve wants to be in the huddle, in the locker room, on the bus bantering with guys after a practice, or in the locker room celebrating after a 2-point win on the road or something. And as a GM, you're spending so much time in Iowa City and Tuscaloosa and College Station and all these places doing scouting, and you're not around the team that much. And even when you're in Phoenix and the Suns are in Phoenix, you're up in your office talking to cranky agents and talking to other GMs trying to make trades. And so there was always to Steve that even though he was a member of the Suns, he wasn't a member of the Suns the way he wanted to be. And it was not a good fit, and that's something that he came to admit.
So he eventually takes the job with the Warriors. There was a lot of controversy around that, even within the team. Remember, for people who don't remember, Mark Jackson had been the coach, and by the way, did a pretty good job. Like, got them to play defense, something Kerr credited them with later. I mean, there were, and I don't know if we want to go down that road, there were real concerns between ownership and Mark Jackson on a number of fronts, and it gets misrepresented at times. But Steve didn't step into it. He had to step into a situation where he had to win the team over because they liked Mark Jackson.
Well, who liked Mark Jackson more than anybody? Stephen Curry.
And yeah.
So talk about having to win over the team. He had to win over the franchise.
Yeah.
You're right on everything you said. There were the issue between Mark Jackson and management was a little bit X's and O's. They wanted to see more ball movement, but it was primarily, the biggest factor was a personality issue. There was this great canyon between Mark Jackson and his bosses, and the Warriors felt they had to resolve that. At the same time, he did a good job that was quickly forgotten because Steve came in and did a better job, and obviously it was the right decision to bring Steve Kerr in. Now we can say that easily when we see how things turned out. But Mark did a good job, and it was controversial. They were he had the locker room. He had 50 wins. He had them in the playoffs. He had them in a game seven on the road, despite being injured in the first round in the playoffs, and still got fired. And Steve realizes this, and he shows up, and one of the first things he says publicly and to the players is, look, Mark Jackson has done a great job here. Look what he's left me. You players, you've done a great job. Look where we're starting at. I owe a lot to what's already in place here. And that showed people a lot. And his lack of ego, his willingness to spread the credit, again, it clearly was not just a suck-up move to Stephen Curry, because for a long time he talked about how much the defense had improved under Mark Jackson, and how some of the young players like Steph and Clay had developed under Mark Jackson. So, again, appreciative. He understood that he had walked in to a much better situation than any first-time head coach had a right to walk into.
The other thing is that I don't think people, I mean, I know people realize he had back pain and that he actually missed time, and there was, you know, all sorts of treatments and surgery and stuff. I don't think people realized how bad it was, like how close he came to saying, I can't do this.
Yeah, that's one of the things we get into in the book that hasn't been talked about really before.
Yeah.
He was starting to have the conversation with himself and the people closest to him, not publicly, but behind the scenes, on as this attempted recovery is going on for weeks and months, and he's still got the dizziness and the headaches and the nausea. He's able to walk for a few steps, and then he's got to reach out to put his arm onto a chair or against a wall so he could get his balance. What started out as a back problem turned into something much worse, because the surgery to fix the back problem led to a spinal fluid leak into his body, and that caused him immeasurable pain and discomfort, and he was having to say, there's a good chance I can't make it back. And this was a dream job for him. He loved everything about the team. He loved that it was close to San Diego, where his family's permanent base still remained. There were so many positives. The team had a big window because Steph and Clay and Draymond were young. There were so many positives, and he's having to sort of say, I don't know that I can come back. And that's one of those big moments in his life where we talk about needing basketball. That's part of it. He got healthy because of basketball. There's no question that that was one of the motivating factors for him, is he needed to get back to basketball so he could get back to a normal life.
I got to think, and I know you haven't spent a ton of time looking forward because you've been so engrossed in this book for a year. I got to think that he sees this coming season, after the mess of the last couple of years and the challenges of COVID and all the injuries this team has gone through, he's got to be excited about the potential, right? Like, this is the kind of situation as a coach where you feel like you can make a difference and start to bring this team back to, if not where it was, certainly a much more competitive space.
Yeah, he's had 2 years of having to keep the car in the garage.
Yeah.
And obviously, Klay Thompson has a lot to prove in terms of, is he going to last until spring, maybe even into June? So we can't really speak to the injuries because we do know that Clay is going to put in whatever work is necessary to get healthy. But if he holds up, I think all Steve Kerr and Steph and Bob Myers and everybody there wants is this one last shot that you just hate, as much as they're appreciative of all the success they've had so far. You know what? Just beat us. Don't have us beat ourselves with injury. We want to get eliminated if we're going to lose. We don't want it to be a what if. So I think they're hoping that this year in particular, and maybe even this next year, because guys are getting older, but as Steph showed us last year, getting older is much different from over the hill, that he's saying, let's get this one last push. And I think he's very excited about this situation, that there's a lot to prove to people, and he thrives in that situation. The guy that couldn't get a scholarship offer, the guy that was not the number 50 pick in the draft, is now back in that same situation, just with a bigger name.
The book, Steve Kerr, Life, is an absolutely fantastic read. Highly recommended. You know, this is one of those things for if you've got basketball friends and family in your life, you know, you can check it off the Christmas list early, man. Those of us who wait till the 23rd don't always get the best gifts, and I am in the middle of that grouping. But here's your opportunity. It is everywhere. You can get it on Amazon, all your favorite bookstores, or might I recommend, try to help out an independent bookstore. They've been hit so hard during the pandemic. Even if you end up ordering it through them, try to go in and help out these local bookstores. Or if you're ordering online, go through Powell's up in or some of the other independents. Not that Jeff Bezos doesn't need more of your money for his rocket ships, but you know there are independent bookstores out there that they could use the help. I think there's going to be a little more talk about this book as you move into a season with Steve Kerr a little more in the spotlight.
Well, I hope so. That's certainly one of the hopes that we have. It came out at an awkward time after the Warriors had been eliminated, but that's just the schedule that the COVID circumstances had forced on us for various reasons. So now, as the enthusiasm returns and maybe the Warriors get back to being the Warriors that look a little bit more familiar, that would be great. If people want to get into the spirit and find out about a pretty amazing life, that would be great. I love what you said about supporting the independent bookstores, and I second it.
Yeah. We were up with my daughter this summer in Oregon. I have a daughter who's now a senior in high school. So we were looking at colleges up that way. She was very excited suddenly about Reed. I'm like, well, it's hard to get into and expensive, so great, that'll go well. But we were in Portland. We toured the University of Oregon and Oregon State, and she's applying to some other schools up there too. But we spent more money at Powell's than I think any one singular place on that whole trip. I'm like, good. Not only that, we're all going to be over 50 pounds with our bags on the way back, because now we've got to add... We brought so many books back. But do try to help out the independents. Scott, thank you for doing this, man. And it's good catching up with you.
I've enjoyed your conversation and appreciate it. It was a fun talk. But most of all, I'm so appreciative of your friendship through the years. I've learned a lot from you. One of the smart NBA minds out there. So this has been great. I had a lot of fun, and thanks for everything.
I look forward to Scott. Hopefully we'll be able to see each other on the road again soon. And I know some places that serve beer. I will be happy to I'll buy you one, buddy. I'd love to see you again.
I look forward to it.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We will be back later this week with another Pro Basketball Talk podcast here at NBC Sports.